Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Well, hello there. Chris Evans here, bringing you a special edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast with Sky from Virgin Radio. In this episode, we're speaking to the impeccably dressed font of knowledge that is Stephen Fry. It's a special one-off pop-up, so do enjoy. He's written a book about ties called Fry's Ties. It's absolutely fascinating. Without further ado, let's hand it over to Dapper Dave for the big intro.
Whether we're talking half Windsors, a Trinity, a Kelvin or a Pratt Shelby, our next guest is the man in the know. His new book, celebrating the humble tie, Fry's Ties, is out now. So please welcome a man well-versed in, well, pretty much everything, to be honest. It's the superb Stephen Fry!
Hello, Stephen.
Oh, what a welcome. Thank you so much, Chris. Lovely
right,
to
now,
be here.
What was he gassing onto you about whilst that last record was playing? This bloke over here.
We're talking about the book. He was kind enough to say pleasant things about it because it does, on the face of it, seem an extraordinary, indeed a preposterous idea to write a book about ties. But on one page, and this is, I suppose, typical of the book, there's a tie which is playing cards. It's a rather beautiful silk playing card tie. And in it, I mentioned that on QI, I performed this unique trick that had never been performed before. I shuffled the cards and produced an order in the pack that had never been seen in the history of playing cards. And that seems like a weird boast, and how can you prove it? But the numbers are so bizarre with cards that the order of a pack of 52 cards is expressed by mathematicians as 52 with an exclamation mark next to it, sometimes called 52 shriek. And it means 52 times 51 times 50 times 49 times 48, etc. Or the other way around, 1 times 2 times 3 times 4, all the way up to 52. And that number is so huge that there is simply no possibility. You'd be more likely to drop a tray of ball bearings and for the ball bearings to spell your name out than for anyone to shuffle the pack into a position that it's been seen in before, unless they're manipulating it as a magician, of course. Anyway, that was just one of those things that is the price you pay for doing QI.
See, I mean, that's, you know, when he comes in with us, when he kicks off with a story like that, we know it's going to be fine. We could go home now. So yeah. Ask Steve one more question. We could nip off, do a bit of Christmas shopping, back at 9:45, he'd still be on.
He moved on to chess.
I know.
The chess thing.
Well, chess is similar. I was quite keen on chess as a teenager, and I remember reading this book by George Steiner called The White Knights of Reykjavik, and in the first paragraph he says chess is a complex game. In fact, there are more possible games of chess than there are atoms in the known universe.
No, that can't be true.
I know, exactly.
That can't be true, can it? Can it?
It seems extraordinary. But if you check it out, it's because the numbers are so vast with permutations of things. And actually, chess gave rise to that famous story, which I always loved, of the emperor, you know, who was rather bored and didn't like the games that were available. He was a shah, like the Shah of Iran, and he asked his viziers and wise people if they could invent one that was fair and reasonable and took intelligence. And someone came up with chess and showed him the moves, and apart from the fact that White has a minimal advantage because it always plays first, it is a very fair game. Everything's open, nothing up your sleeve, etc. Anyway, the emperor was so pleased, he offered whatever reward the man wanted. And he said, oh, it's very simple. All you have to do is, you see there is the 8x8 checkerboard on which we play the game. If you put a grain of rice on one square, and then two on the next, and four on the next, and so on. That's all. And the emperor thought, well, I got away with that. That was easy.
Bargain.
Called for a sack of rice and put one on and two on, and then they slowly realised that this was not going to be as easy. And in order to fill the 64th and last square would take more rice than has ever been grown in the history of the planet.
No, it's that...
It's trillions
happens, it all happens that quickly.
Zillions of numbers, yes. It's called an exponential curve, and it is frightening how fast... And, of course, we know about exponential because of...
Virus.
Because of the virus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was thinking the same thing.
The rate at which doubles. And there are more famous and benign ones. There's a thing called Moore's Law. Have you come across that?
I think I've heard of it.
It's a man called Gordon Moore who founded the integrated electronics company, Intel. And the very first integrated chips, silicon chip semiconductors, fitted a number of transistors. And in the early 60s, he predicted that every 18 months or so, they'd be able to double the number of transistors in the same space, which doesn't sound like much of a boast. But again, by doubling and doubling and doubling, you come up with the computing we have now. You'll remember the early days in the 80s of microcomputers and things
ZX
like that.
Spectrum 82. Yeah.
And in 1999, I think they built a thing called, it began with an A, like an Altair computer. Not the Altair, that was the one of the very early ones, but it began with an A, and it was the most powerful computer in the world. Mm-hmm. 3-4 years later, the PlayStation that was in most kids' bedrooms had the equal power. That's how, because it doubles. And when it doubles from a high number, it's amazing what happens.
And that's why it's playing havoc with our mental health, because we can't evolve as fast as we need to keep up with the one thing we were always master over at Servant.
Yes, the amount of memory and real-time activity you can have online now is so astonishing. Yeah. As you say, our brains seem... I wonder if they are, though, you know, because I think sometimes people underestimate that extraordinary thing we have between our ears. And an example I give, which still amazes me, is that if you stand in the countryside and you look around and it's pretty empty and there's a little bit of wind and somewhere in the distance there's a copse or a spinney of, you know, trees, and the wind turns a leaf so that the silver back shines, you catch it from ages away, and you look and you see it so quickly because we've evolved to respond to things like that, because it could be lunch or it could be something that thinks we're lunch, so you've got to be aware of these movements. Well, that's fine, we understand that. But 2 hours later, you can stand in the middle of Oxford Street with thousands of people around you in bright colours, on the phone, cars coming towards you, hopping across the street, avoiding the taxis and the buses, talking on the phone, and your brain is processing all this astounding amount of subsidiary noise. The same brain that saw one tiny thing and immediately focused on it is capable of blanking out. Because so often what the brain does that's brilliant is not the processing, it's when it inhibits itself, when it closes down other things so you can concentrate on one, and then it allows you to shut off these amazing signals that are coming at you in so many colours and noises and speeds, and yet we cope without even thinking.
We do. I mean, the only thing about the technology is the dopamine thing, because and that homeostasis and all that kind of stuff.
That's very true. And I think medicine is only really coming round to the immense importance of these endocrines, I think they call them, don't they? These hormones and things. And the place of the gut in producing them, which is so fascinating.
Yeah, no, we did this thing about whole body yeses and whole body noes, and you've got to drop into your body. And the more of your body you use, the better decision you're going to make, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it does make sense.
There's the four eyes. There's the intellect, there's instinct, there's impulsiveness, and there's intuition. And they say the best one out of those four temples to deal with is intuition, because it's got a bit of your EQ, sorry, your IQ, your EQ, and your BQ. Basically,
yeah, that's fascinating. It's,
and it's all about feeling, and you know, let's go back to your book on the feeling, right? Yes. Because the point about your book is, you know, I heard you talking about it on other shows, and I've read about the book, but I hadn't read the book, and I thought this is a nice little bank raid that Fry has cooked up for himself. And it's a nice ruse. It's a novelty book, but then I read it, Stephen. It's a fantastic book. It felt great. I'm telling you, I was taken away with it about the attention to detail. I call it the icky guy-ness of the book. And you know, it's stunning. And had you have phoned it in, or even, you know, slightly better than phoned in, it wouldn't have been any good. But because you've gone all in on you've nerded right down into the ties, then I'm on board.
Yeah, I think that is the purpose and the delight of these things, that a small small, insignificant thing, in many ways, that nowadays a hated thing. You know, most people of our generation associate ties with school, male and girls wear them too, you know, in school sometimes. And therefore, as a symbol of something we can't wait to get rid of, because it's a symbol of the working world and job interviews and grown-ups.
Forced discipline.
Offices, exactly. And so you just pull it off and you say, I'm never going to wear one of those again. and that's completely understandable. But there's another way of looking at it. This is the only little area of real estate that a man has in which you can sort of, I mean, of course, you're allowed to wear all kinds of flamboyant things, but it's a heck of a statement. I mean, I'm wearing this tie. I'll tell you the story of it later. I've told it before, so you've probably heard it, but it's a Versace tie. It's so vibrant with colour that it doesn't clash with anything because it clashes with itself. And but if I wore a jacket like that, then you'd think, well, hang on, does he think he's Elton John? What's he about to go on stage? You know, it's such a statement.
He better have a few number ones up his sleeve.
Exactly. and if you wore it as socks, well, that's fine too, but people don't really look at each other's ankles that much. But just parked around the neck and falling down, it's just enough to express some pattern and colour and form and texture and then a sort of excitement with it, as well as all the other things a tie can do as sort of tokens of belonging to various clubs or regiments or whatever it might be. So there's a lot going on, and there's an amazing history to them. And in my case, I suppose what I do is I tell the story of how, growing up in the country, one of the things that gave me pleasure was, you know, putting on my grandfather's old togs, including these starched shirts, collars, you know, separate collars on a shirt, and the ties that he left behind. And I would parade up and down Norwich looking like a ridiculous young fogey at the age of 14 in a suit and tie. And
a young fogey, that's funny, isn't it? You talk about the invention of shirts in the book as well, and you say, you know, the first renowned or supposed shirtier, and then you put in brackets, not a real word. It should be.
Shouldn't it?
Shirtier is such a great... if you make shirts, you should be a shirtier.
Exactly, it's true. It's true, like a chocolatier and, and so on, yeah.
Oh, my goodness, man. He doesn't want to know a shirtier.
On the other hand, you would say a trouserman. He's a trouserman. Once a trouserman, always a trouserman.
No, trousier.
A trousier?
Yeah, why not? You know?
Maybe a pantalonier, but a trouserman.
A pantaloonie. Right, so what do ties matter, Jeeves, at a time like this? There is no time, sir, at which ties do not matter. Have they always mattered in your life? Have you had a tie-less year or two or something like
that? Oh, yes. I mean, like anyone, especially during lockdown, that was sort of weirdly the point, is because everyone was suddenly informally in sweatpants or whatever they're called these days and various joggery-type things, unstructured, elasticated, wasted objects around them.
Joggery-type thing. Joggier.
Joggies, exactly. And I was tidying out my drawers, and I saw all these ties, and I thought, well, this is, and it's a great thing to buy as a memento when you travel, because it's unique, and in different towns and cities and countries, they have different styles of shop. In Italy, they have amazing places for ties, in France and Norway, completely different as well. But also, of course, you can put it in your luggage and it weighs almost nothing. Yeah. You can stuff it away. But if you buy books or ornaments, it's a real bore lugging them around. So there's that advantage.
And who doesn't enjoy rolling or folding a tie? There's a reassurance in that. It's very comforting, isn't it? It's very meditative.
Yes, absolutely right. Absolutely right.
One of the ties I was most drawn to in the book was an early Ralph Lauren or Polo Ralph Lauren sort of a woolly sort of knitted tie, which was squared off at the end. And as a kid, I used to love those because usually my dad wore them and they would have a sort of silk bit in the middle that went through round under the collar because it would upset the collar too much.
It would slim down. Just for
but
that.
How many of those kind of ties do you
quite
have?
A few, actually, because that's how all the woolen ties and knitted silk.
Right.
I remember reading. I liked the Bond movies, as everyone did. My brother and I would go and see them when they came out. But then when I was about 12, I discovered the books, and I hadn't realised what a wonderful writer Ian Fleming was. An incredible gift for description and so on, and just really a fine writer. And I remember in one of them, I can't remember, I mean, there's so many fabulous quotes. I was just reminded one of the other day, and I think it's the second chapter of Casino Royale begins, Bond lit his 80th cigarette of the day.
Wow.
and here's one that anyone who has had a drinking problem or who knows someone who drinks too much will recognise exactly what Fleming meant. To Bond, the best drink of the day was always the drink he had in his head before the first drink of the day.
Goodness me.
Doesn't that, yeah. Isn't that, you know that? It's that one, it's that platonic ideal of a drink that, and you're chasing that idea throughout the rest of the day when you slug it all down. It never quite matches. But anyway, so there are lots of brilliant things. But also Bond goes to Jermyn Street in St. James's, you know, just off Piccadilly, the heart of the menswear, the fine gentleman's accessorising shops. And he goes to New and Lingwood, one of the best of them, and he orders a Sea Island cotton navy blue shirt. And a black knitted silk tie, and he wears them. And actually, you can picture, I think Connery actually wore exactly that. It's a wonderfully, it's somewhere between a subtle jazz man.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just got a little hit. It's so, and I remember going, when I was therefore about 14, going to New and Lingwood precisely to order the same thing.
Yeah, because it's not too sharp for its own good, but it's sharp.
Exactly. Yeah.
I like it. It's good. And because it's Woolly, it's a bit more playful.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as sort of aggressive. One of the ties that isn't in the book, but there's a picture of you wearing a tie, the tie that's not in the book, is your University Challenge tie.
Yes, no, I brought that along with me.
But it's not in the book, is it? Because there's a picture of you wearing it. Is that enough, I suppose?
I think there is, yeah, because it's actually under a rather splendid story. It's a very embarrassing thing to admit to, but this tie is actually, it's not my college tie, it's the tie of a club within the college called the Cherubs, which is a drinking club. And when I was elected to the Cherubs, it was only a male college. But in my last year, it went female. And I was visiting there the other day, and I was very pleased to discover the women have got a similar club, which has got the brilliant name of the Valkyries. Okay. So there's the Valkyries.
Don't mess with the Valkyries.
And in the Cherubs, one of the initiation ceremonies was to drink an enormous amount out of some silver chalice that was hundreds of years old. And you had to promise how you would honour the Cherubs and the tie that you were being given to prove your membership of this club. And I said, rather grandly, I'm going to wear it on television. And everyone looked at me, but I knew I was because I'd just been picked for the college's University Challenge team.
Right.
So I wore it for that. But the guy next to me, he was a splendid fellow, and I hadn't met him before. He was a little older than me, a graduate. And he said, oh, I'm going to take this cherub's tie where cherubs live, and this is where it needs to be, up in the heavens. And we looked at him and thought, what's he talking about? And it turned out that this guy, right, whose name was Mike, he was, in the vacations, he was doing fast jet training with the RAF. He was learning, teaching himself Russian, and his postgraduate work was in astrophysics. He was planning to be an astronaut, and he became an astronaut, Mike Fold. And to this day, he has the British record for the number of days in space, 372 days in space, or whatever. So he completely blew the rest of us away with his boast. It wasn't a boast. It was modestly stated that he would take his tie. So he did on his first
launch. That's one way to set your intentions, isn't it? Because, I mean, that is manifestation.
Yeah, and exactly. That is someone who, you know, I mean, there are two ways, I suppose, in young life, aren't there? There's to know exactly what you want and to fix on it, as he did.
Yeah.
He knew precisely, and he did everything. Or there is, you know, the other way, which is never to know every time you wake up in the morning who you are, and what you're going to do.
Yeah.
The French existentialist way of doing it, I suppose you could call it. Oscar Wilde said that those who know what they want to be in life, well, grocer, general, you know, politician, soldier, whatever it might be, will invariably become it. That is their punishment.
Yeah.
But those who live what he called the artistic life or the dynamic life, they have no idea what they're going to be from one day to the next, almost, and that is their reward. But, of course, it's a harder life to lead.
Yeah, of course it is.
And it's very hard on others.
Well, you know, the bigger the rollercoaster, the sicker you feel from time to time.
Well put.
So to cravat or not to cravat or when to, right?
Yeah.
If you are going to cravat ever, you need to cravat like it's either 1999 or page 220 of Stephen's book. Because that is the best cravat I've ever seen. I would wear that for the rest of my life.
It's glorious, isn't it?
It's the way, it's the colour, it's the way it's nestling down within the collar and the collar. But it's also also the pattern, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is lovely. And that's one of the wonderful things is to celebrate. In Britain, there is a marvellous silk weaving industry using Jacquard looms and old style ways. It comes all the way back from our wave of immigrants that we had in the 17th century, mostly, the Huguenots who came to Spitalfields and had this. They were the French Protestants who were kicked out because it's obviously France was Catholic and didn't like Protestants, and so they came over here for shelter and refuge, and they brought with them their amazing skills in weaving, and then a lot of them moved out to Suffolk and to various other parts as new waves of Jewish and that, and now of course Islamic and various other. It's a wonderful thing about the same buildings in Spitalfields can have been a chapel, a synagogue, and a mosque, and it's that's its history. Anyway, the weaving, the history of British weaving is a wonderful one, and it's beautiful what you can do. And of course, it's connected to computing.
I've never bow tied ever. No. There are sort of mini micro tying masterclasses in here.
Yes, yeah.
I was always a half Windsor guy. The full Windsor was just a bit too scary for me. But looking at your beautifully simple diagram, I should have gone for it.
Well, it's worth it. Yep. I mean, either the full or the half, and there are various other.
Wait, what is your go to? Not is that a half?
This is a half Windsor.
Yeah, because it's got the slightly wonky halves. They are.
They are, and this particular tie is so patterned. It's got a little red bit at the top, and I wanted to make the knot red, which I think I succeeded in doing.
You did.
So you had to sort of get
like matching your flock wallpaper.
Although, to return to Ian Fleming, there is a phrase in one of the books again, which is that Bond never trusted anybody who wore a Windsor knot or suede shoes.
And no reason why, just because.
Just because.
Yeah, maybe too much time on the hands, who would know, and creeping about in their suede shoes. Right, I've dog-eared loads of these. Your Paul Smith tie, and you talk about Paul Smith so fondly in the first Paul Smith shop, which I went to a lot, you know. Paul Smith, just wonderful.
I had it. Yes, I'm so embarrassed about this, and I'm not saying this in order. It sounds like a humble brag or something, but I went regularly to the Paul Smith, so regularly that eventually the manager said, "Oh, here's this card. It'll give you a 20% discount."
I got
or something.
The same card.
And so I never went back in again because I was too embarrassed to use it. I thought it was shameful. I mean, it is, and I'm not trying to present myself as a saint, but, you know, unto him that hath shall be given and more, unto
always.
Them that hath not shall be taken more and more. It's so unfair. And the last thing I needed was, I was fortunate enough to be able to pay the full price.
His full whack.
So it had a reverse effect, really. I just stopped going in.
Have you met him? Have you told him that?
I have, yeah, and he grinned and said I was not the only one, and I'd be very welcome to go in and pay the full price or more if I chose.
Did you ever see that Paul Smith taxi that's around?
Oh, yes, gorgeous.
Yeah, is it just with one, or are there a few
stripes
of those?
There are a few, and I've actually got a bag that's got a mini with those stripes in
yeah, they're
in
great,
the wood.
Those,
they're really
aren't they?
Good. Yeah.
And how are you with your taxis nowadays? Because you had one for a while.
I had one for many, many years,
right.
Yeah, for 25 years at least.
Cab.
It was a black cab,
right.
And I loved going around, and it was fantastic. And in the early days, it was quite straightforward. I was filming the Jeeves and Worcester series that I did with Hugh Laurie, but so it was back in the late 80s, and when I first bought one, and I remember one day I drove it to the location or the set, and when I got back after the day's shooting, the prop department very sweetly had made up a plaque on the back, and in the old days it used to say license to carry 5 passengers, and then a number, and then underneath it would say Metropolitan Police, because they used to look after the taxi department in those days. It's now TfL, of course. And so they made up one, and it said not licensed to carry any passengers in small letters, and then the number, which was my birth date, and underneath it Neapolitan Police. But you had to look very closely to spot that it was fake, and that worked well for many, many years, and I would park in taxi ranks and in other places like that, very naughtily. And then one day I got in it, and there was a note on the seat, and it was locked, and I had an alarm and everything, because it was the days when people were always stealing, stereos out of cars. And it was from the police, from the special branch. And they had said that we have searched this car. And, of course, I realised that there'd been a terrible bomb in Ealing, with, which apparently had used, the IRA had used a black cab.
Right.
And they saw this black cab and they obviously saw it and they got very suspicious. But they then tracked it back to me and said I had 5 days to get rid of the white plaque. So
what did you do? How long did the taxi survive the white plaque's demise?
Well, I just got rid of it. And,
the whole thing? Oh, right, the whole thing.
Yeah, I put a blank white plaque on, so rather than just having nothing.
Right.
And then, of course, the congestion fee came in, so I obviously could no longer really use the taxi lanes, which was the great advantage.
Yeah. It's like when the Olympics was on, we were given Olympic lane passes, weren't we, for a while?
That was awesome.
That was a pretty good couple of weeks, let me tell you. Wow. Larging it to the Olympic
Stadium. Straight in down the A40 and the fast lane.
Yeah, do you know what? I got 3 speeding fines.
Really?
Yeah, because I wasn't used to being able to go like, I was only going like 55, but always, you used to go like 17 miles an hour just on the Brompton Road, because it's 30 miles an hour, but it's dual carriageway. Anyway.
That's right, for those who don't remember, it was the special lanes with the Olympic rings painted on them, weren't they?
Yeah, and then they burned them off, and there's potholes now wherever they are, and they're irreparable.
There's a legacy.
There is.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
An arm and a legacy. So this is a very beautiful tie, the flowered tie.
I like that one, and I was terribly surprised when I turned it over and saw that it was Bowden, because Bowden is mostly a mail catalogue thing, I think, or what used to be called mail catalogue, and these days an online catalogue, I suppose. I think they still send it through the post, and it's sort of associated with rather kind of home counties, Oxford sort of, almost the Red Trouser Brigade, you know. But that tie is just lovely gold with the simple flowers on it.
Put me in mind of Hockney. And then I started thinking about the Mutual and Rothschild wine labels, where they commission an artist to design every one. And I would love, you know, I mean, you know David Hockney.
Have you
ever had a tie conversation with him? Can you imagine a Hockney tie?
That would be
sensational. That'd be awesome, wouldn't it?
Funnily enough, a friend of mine was a painter called Craigie Aitchison, who's a wonderful painter, a Scottish painter, famous for these wonderful, flat, beautifully coloured, elegant paintings that nearly always featured, rather weirdly, a Bedlington Terrier in them somewhere, and a sun and a moon. A very, very particular style. And he painted a tie for the Royal Academy, which is absolutely sensational. I managed to find one. I lost mine. And they're kind of like Egyptian hieroglyph type things, but quite hard to describe them. But they're, you can occasionally see one on eBay. They're very, very lovely. But yes, I was lucky enough to be on David Hockney's email list when he started painting with iPads, digital tablets, and he would send me his work, and it was really weird to be getting an original Hockney through email, but of course infinitely reproducible. And he was very cross with me because I'd given up smoking.
Yeah.
So this is about 15 years ago when I gave up smoking, I guess. And he is a resolute smoker.
He's an enthusiastic smoker.
And when people tell him not to smoke, he says, "Oh, don't be dreary." That's his word, dreary. Because he sounds like Alan Bennett, because they come from the same
so
part
similar,
of the world. Yeah. And he drew me a special one of a full ashtray, a beautiful, beautiful Hockney of a full ashtray, and he'd handwritten underneath, "This is what you're missing." Actually, a full ashtray didn't make me feel particularly sorrowful.
We've never been able to interview him because he's said yes to interviews, but he won't do an interview where he can't smoke. And back at the Beeb and in here, he just won't do it because he smokes from the minute he gets up to the minute he goes to bed.
He does, and he's unfortunate as far as anti-smokers are concerned, because he seems to be
one of the best advert. He's like the 115-year-old woman in France that everybody talks about all the time.
The one who knew Van Gogh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True story.
Yes. And Tom Stoppard still smokes all the time.
But also, Hockney is a big tie guy. You know, he often cardigans and ties.
Absolutely.
Have you had
right.
a tie conversation with
no,
him?
No, I should have done. I really should. He's a wonderful dresser, isn't he? And he invented a certain kind of look. There's a great story about him, which I heard, and I asked him if it was true, and he said it was. When he was very young, and he was a promising artist, Faber and Faber, the publishers who published, well, T.S. Eliot, and T.S. Eliot was on the board of Faber and Faber, and Ted Hughes and W.H. Auden, the great poets of the day, really, and they were bringing out new editions of W.H. Auden. Now, I don't know if you know what W.H. Auden looked like towards the end of his life. He looked like sort of Chief Joseph or one of those old Native American figures with really lined face, deep trenches everywhere, really, yeah. really lined. Anyway, David Hockney was invited to this party in Bloomsbury to meet W.H. Auden so that he could draw him for the covers, which he did, and they were brilliant. But he'd never seen him before, of course. He'd heard of him. He's a famous poet. And he came into the party and someone said, that's Whiston over there. W.H. Auden's name was Whiston. And Hockney looked at him and said, blimey, if that's his face, what can his scrotum look like?
Maybe it's the opposite.
Who knows?
It's a portrait in the basement, not the attic.
Oh, very good. Who that's knows? Very possible.
Who knows? We've got to talk about the MCC tie.
Yes.
Just give people a little sort of bluffer's guide to the MCC and the tie, and when was the first time you wore it? Because it's a design classic. It's a beautiful tie.
It's known as the bacon and egg. The bacon is pretty unfair because it's kind of wonderful dark orange, burnt orange,
it's
and a yellow. It's a lovely tie, striped tie. The Marylebone Cricket Club is the place that runs Lord's Cricket Ground, and for 200 or so years used to run cricket around the world. It's still responsible for formulating the laws of cricket, and you know how a grounded catch is defined and all, you know, the intricacies, but obviously it doesn't govern world cricket anymore. But it's a club, and it has at the moment, I believe, a 29-year waiting list. It's absurd, but it allows you into the extraordinary grounds if you're a cricket fan, and to see matches and so on, and people are very pleased to be it. And I actually a month or so ago was utterly stunned to see in my inbox an email from Kumar Sangakkara, who's one of the greatest cricketers who's ever lived, a left-handed batsman, and he was president, the first non-white, I think, non-British, certainly, president of the MCC, and a superb one too. And he was writing to ask me to deliver what is known as the MCC Cowdrey Lecture on the Spirit of Cricket, which has been going for many years. It's never been asked. No other non-cricketer, except Desmond Tutu, has ever been asked to do it. So
I heard he played a bit in his day.
Well, it was around the time, obviously, that South Africa was emerging as one of the, again, after Mandela came, was free, and it became a democratic country and welcomed back into the world, including in cricket and sport generally. So he had a lot to say, obviously, about racism and so on. And I was preparing my lecture when this terrible stink arose in Yorkshire about the racism that had been experienced by Azim Rafiq and others. And so I suddenly thought, my God, here's this big, fat, white, middle-class Englishman presuming to lecture on the spirit of cricket. And indeed, it turned out it was on the very day that Azim was giving his evidence to the Select Committee in the House of Parliament. But fortunately, my lecture was on the way cricket has changed over the years. And I used to go as a boy. And, when you know, in 1962, it seems extraordinary, but and indeed in, I think into 63, they still had a division between amateurs and professionals. And the amateurs were known as the gentlemen, and the professionals were known as players. And every year there was a gentleman versus players match. And in the England team, though, the captain would always be a gentleman. So the last one was A.R. Lewis, Tony Lewis, the great, great Welsh cricketer and a great man. And so his name on the match card would say Mr. A.R. Lewis. But at the bottom, where the bowler, say, who was a professional, it would say Truman, F.S., for Fred Truman. Not Mr. He didn't get it. And when they travelled on abroad on Ashes tours or wherever,
they went in different classes. I mean, it was unspeakable. And that was in my lifetime. That was around the time the Beatles first went to Abbey Road. You know,
crazy.
So all that changed. And then, you know, other things changed. And amazing changes that were always met with resistance. And they didn't use the word woke there, but it was always, oh, there's this trendy nonsense about having women in the game. Or what's all this one day? That, what are all these colours? And why are they, you know, what are they, lit up bales? It looks like a gay disco. You know, they were just everybody... Everything is always in cricket, as in so much in this country. Is any change is met with the kind of, oh, it's just nonsense, you know. And then we accept it. I can remember around the same time that cricket was changing at its most, people were saying women should get paid the same as men for the same work. And, you know, half the country, or in terms of its political party, voted against it in Parliament as if this was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's to us now. You're going, what? So who? Someone might still be alive who voted no to equal pay for women in the 70s. It seems extraordinary. And I've benefited from that kind of progress. I'm not wanting to get on a woke soapbox exactly, but, you know, I'm a married man. I'm a gay man who married the man he loves. And that was inconceivable when I was growing up and parading myself in ties. Maybe the ties were a kind of defence against the knowledge I had that my life would be one of shame and exile and skulking and not, you know, not being my proper self, as it were, because I never predicted that the world would get better.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot wrong with the world, of course there is, but it does get better.
Yeah, there's a lot wrong with the world, but there's a lot more right with the world than we thought was possible, maybe, within our lifetime.
And I'm fed up with some members of my own generation moaning about not being able to say anything. So what?
Do you want to say?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah,
What is it that you're prevented from saying? Tell me.
Yeah.
And they never can, of course. They just sort of want to growl and grumble in a sort of grumpy old man way.
Your detail, you know, your attention to detail, your eye for detail, your ear for detail, your heart and your brain for detail is fantastic. But I think the reason you tell such good stories and remember things so well is because you take notice of the detail, things are more memorable.
Oh, yeah. I think that may be true.
And
yes.
It's a more pleasant journey, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. I mean, it means you're never bored.
Yeah.
Because you know, if I'm a bit of a sort of mania for being on time, so I'm always early.
You were early here today.
I was early here today.
You were shown around the 17th floor. You were so early.
Indeed, and wonderful it was. So I often have to sit in cafes or in that's where you look at people. And my favourite writers have that same ability. I mean, I've just been rereading a lot of John le Carré because he died, and it just reminded me of how much I liked him. And I remember in The Looking Glass War, one of his early spy novels, there's a character who punches his arm out to the left and sweeps it to look at his watch as if to say he had knocked around the world a bit. And it's just such perfect observation, you know, the way someone would just...
It's so playful just, as well, isn't it?
Just do that. And it does say, I've knocked around the world a bit.
Yeah,
and it's playful. It's kind of good observational comedy. And you get a huge amount of
but
that.
But it's also so... I mean, you know, pithiness is a sign of intelligence, isn't it? When you do all the heavy lifting for your reader or for your listener, where you're concerned.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. And it is in the details. I remember Nabokov, the Russian-American novelist, just picking out a piece of Dickens where, because of Dickens' ability to find details where no one else would. And Pip, I think it is in Great Expectation, he tips someone who's carried his luggage and he flicks him a coin and the man catches it with an overhand wrist and gives a nod. And you're instantly there. I'd never heard the phrase catching a coin with an overhand wrist, but you know what that means.
Yeah, of course
you do. That little snatch that isn't the usual way of, you know, letting it land in the palm. And it just, for a second, this figure is alive. And Nabokov said that is, you know, part of that genius. And it's what I love in the best writers is they've just seen things for you and they make them...
They bring them alive.
It's like what Oscar Wilde said when he famously remarked that nature imitates art, not art imitating nature, but nature imitates art. And people said, oh, he's just being clever and putting things backwards again. But his point was is that once Turner had looked at a sunset in a particular way, He made us see the sunset in a different way. Mm. So in a sense, nature was, when we looked at the window, nature was now imitating Turner. We'd never seen before what Turner saw in a sunset.
Yeah.
But as soon as he saw it, we saw it too. And that's a marvellous thing that happens, I think, with the best artists.
Right, we haven't got long left. Wilde versus Dickens, world title fight.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
They're allowed one paragraph each, 9-10 lines. That's it.
I mean, I think Wilde would be a finer companion. I mean, I admire Dickens enormously. It is, I'll just quickly put this point in, more theatres were built in London in the 19th century than had ever been built in the world anywhere at any other time. And yet, there's only one play we remember from that huge Victorian reign, which is The Importance of Being Earnest. The rest are nearly all just melodramas and nothing like as good. And I think it was Terry Eagleton or someone like that who pointed out that, in fact, that's because the dramatic energy of the British, which had expressed itself as Shakespeare in the great period of the 1580s and 90s and so on, and it was turned into the novel, and the novel became the drama form. And Dickens, in a sense, is a dramatist like Wilde.
OK, so the winner is?
As I'm in the borough, virtually, which is his manor, I'd better say Dickens.
OK.
Because Dickens had created complete worlds that you can revisit and revisit. Wilde was more of an intellectual hero, more of a kind of a crown prince of Bohemia.
But if you read the first page of Picture of Dorian Gray or the first page of Christmas Carol, you're taken away with the magnificence of the paragraphs. Yeah. You go, I've got to have a rest after this one. I just need to let that paragraph soak in because it's so good.
Isn't it?
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous how good it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, before you go, Fry's Ties. It's a read, everyone. It is a cracking read. It's beautiful. I think I find it really meditative. I find it really calming, really reassuring. I was fascinated by your enthusiasm for your ties. You know, Desert Island Ties is what it could be called as well. We are hoping for another one. We're hoping for Fry's Cries. Your best cries and your worst cries. We're hoping for Fry's Pies.
Pies. Now
any chance, please, Stephen?
Pies, I could certainly... that would be fun to dedicate myself for a year in mastering... Yeah,
I'd be... The pictures would be better than the cries. Yeah. You'd have to go back to recreate all the cries.
Yeah, that's true.
Anything else? Fry's Dies? No.
We don't want Fry's... No.
Dies. We don't want Fry's Dies. sorry, I've monopolised the conversation. Anything you want to add, Vass?
Well, I have one question. You were talking about things that are wrong with the world, and I have another one here, and it's practically the first tie you talk about, and this beautiful tie of ancient Greece, which you say it's sadly unworn.
Yes.
What? By the way, he's Greek, just so you know.
But the author of Mythos and Troy and Heroes hasn't worn this beautiful, albeit black and white, tie of ancient Greek mythology.
It's from the frieze from the Parthenon, and it represents the Panathenaic Games. And I have this passion...
You idiot.
That we will return the Parthenon marbles to Athens, and I will wear the tie at the ceremony in which the friezes get installed at the new Acropolis Museum in Athens, where they belong. And I'm really keen on this, and I know a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, we've looked after them. And it's certainly true we've looked after them, but it will be such a classy act. And the technology now, and of course it's been done before with them, there's another set in Scotland where Lord Elgin lived, who the chap who brought them here, because you can cast them, and now with laser refinement you can cast them so exactly. So the British Museum would have a Parthenon experience. Yeah. You go in, you see this fabulous technology using AR helmets or whatever you want to, you know, wear, not helmets, but you know. Yeah. And you see how the originals were perfectly reproduced and put in place, and then you watch the them being packed up and put on a train, and you have this wonderful kind of 3D panoramic experience of them riding through France and across Italy and down through the Baltics and into, not the Baltics, the Balkans, and then into Greece, and then where they would be welcome, where I promise you, a million Athenians would come onto the street to welcome. They mean so much to the Greeks. They are part of the nature
of
what Athens is.
It's an open goal, isn't it?
It is. And there would be a handshake ceremony, and, you know, Boris or whoever was Prime Minister.
Boris This is the man.
Suddenly there would be, you know, people would for once look at Britain and say, that was a classy act.
He could do it in fluent ancient Greek, yeah. apparently.
But the word is classy. It would be a classy thing. And Britain hasn't done a classy thing internationally.
It'd be both glassy and classy, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. So that's my plan. Then I will wear that tie on that occasion.
Good answer. Happy with that?
Yeah, very happy with that.
All right, Stephen, you're a dream guest. You're a dream human being. We love you. And happy Christmas.
Thank you. Okay. Happy Christmas to you and your listeners. Cheers. Thank you very much.
Stephen Fry Fry's Ties, The Life and Times of a Tie Collection. All right, here we go. Well, there we go. We're done.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky.
Virgin Radio.
The wonderfully charming brain box that is Stephen Fry there chatting about his intricate new book, Ties, Fry's Ties, which is out now. If you enjoy this podcast special, make sure to subscribe to the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast wherever you get yours to hear the weekly roundup of all the best bits. Ta-ta.